So the big question is this: what would you do if money didn't matter? Say you had millions in your bank account, what would you focus on? Would you spend more time with your family, with your wife, with your kids, take family vacations? Would you pursue your gifts and talents and dreams, serve your local community, teach others, serve your church community? You see, if what you would do if money didn't matter is pursue your gifts and talents and dreams to serve others, then that is probably what you should be doing. The problem is, most people are in the rat race, living 5 inches in front of their face with no time to pursue what they were born to do. That is the problem, and the solution is to develop enough passive income to replace your working income so you can quit your job and be free to live your life the way you were created to. That is the solution, and this podcast will show you how. What's going on, everybody? This is Ryan Ank with Cashflow Dad Life, coming at you with another episode. We've got an amazing guest on, probably one of the most impressive people that I can think of. He has gone from teacher, like me, start off. Actually, we got similar stories, except I didn't have the level of success that you have. But he went from teacher, cranked out a bunch of kids, was like, crap, I need to find a way to provide for my family. Got some credit lines and bought 2 fourplexes, and now owns a company, Avesta, that owns $1.13 billion in assets. And which is a pretty amazing feat. So, guys, we're on the line here with an absolute Trojan. I don't know if that's the right word. Trojan just came to mind. I don't even know why. It's like a tycoon. Real estate tycoon, Rob Reynolds. Want to see if you're there and on the line, and if you can hear me, all right.
Hey, thanks a lot, Ryan. Thanks for having me. And yeah, man, all's clear. I was also thrown off by that Trojan comment.
I wasn't sure what to say after that. I was like, Trojan horse. I don't know. I threw myself off. Sorry about that.
Yeah, you're good.
Well, can you kind of walk us through? You actually have a really incredible story. And as a husband, how many kids you have now?
I have 6 daughters.
Six daughters, man. Completely opposite of me. I don't know how to make girls, and you don't know how to make a penis.
Yeah, I guess I don't have any Y chromosomes. I'm not sure, man.
But yeah.
I kind of hold to the fact that I think my wife must be killing all the Y chromosomes in utero. So.
Well, don't let her around my wife because she might share some secrets.
Nice.
I don't have weddings to pay for right now.
Right.
6 of them. Unless they all go to the convent, which is, you know.
Hopefully that tradition changes with that whole bride's family paying for the wedding.
Good luck. Good luck between now and the time they get married. Yeah. So can you kind of walk us through, like, so you're a teacher. You've got a couple kids, and probably like most teachers, you're thinking, man, this just isn't going to make things, it's just not going to make ends meet.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, my wife, Maria, she was kind of the mentality, hey, listen, when we start having kids, I would really like to stay at home. And, you know, I thought to myself, man, that's cool. You know, my parents didn't do that. They were actually both teachers themselves. But I thought, you know, there's no better person to raise my kids than her. So I was like, all right, I'll figure it out. So I was teaching in the Northeast, actually in New York. Early on, I realized, okay, I'm going to have some other type of supplemental income. And my brother, Peter, graduated after me from college and really was passionate about getting into real estate. And he's like, yo, Rob, let's do this. So I'm like, sure, real estate sounds good. You know, sounded to me like a passive income play, I think. And, you know, I'm like, cool. So you just get some property and you just collect rent, you know, and it's that easy.
Right.
But obviously it's definitely not like that.
Right. Especially not the way you did it.
Yeah. And you know what, man, a lot of people come out of college and they think they're something with their degree, which is nothing. And, and then they think they're not going to have to work for, you know, to really come up, you know. And I see this all the time too, in owning a company and people, you know, the young people coming out of college, they want to be CEO in 5 years. I'm like, dude, it's not, it doesn't work like that. So, right. So I get out, I'm teaching, looking for other income. Our brother graduates college. He's like, let's do real estate. Cool, man. I have no idea what that's about. My parents being teachers are like, are you crazy? Don't do this. And 2005, we get a couple 4-unit rental properties in the Northeast. And, you know, within a year, it was 2005. So anyone who was an adult for that time period, you realize that's before the recession of,
right,
you know, 2008. I would say mid 2007 is really when it happened to us. But so everything was going great, and you could, you know, you didn't have, you know, there was people that couldn't pay their cell phone bills that were buying homes.
Right. Just,
you know, something had to give, right? But we didn't see it. But we got 2 4-unit places, rented them out. We even got money at closing. Like, it was 103% financed. So,
right,
you know, we were in leverage heaven or hell looking back at it. But right, we put in the money that we got back at closing, we put it into the property, and within a year they're both worth a lot more. Yeah, they're reappraised for a lot more money. So we took out lines of credit on both, and then we got a lot more stuff in the Northeast. And by 2007, we had about, let's say, between me, my brother, and one other friend of ours, Dan French, we had probably like 90 apartments and probably, wow, maybe 25 buildings. And yeah, so that was by 2007, and yeah, we thought we were ballers, man, hip hoppers, and all was good. We just thought anything we touched was gold, and then the market turned, man, and we realized what we were touching was dust. And yeah, we had to fight through it. It was, I remember, Ryan, it was like June 2007. It was a month after my first daughter was born. We were married for a year, and it stuff hit the fan. We went through 3 different property managers for most of our apartments, and they were just screwing us left and right. Yeah. And, you know, charging $60 to change a light bulb type thing on their invoices. I'm like, what the heck? People stopped paying rent. They couldn't find new renters. You know, it was chaotic. And I remember looking at each other and we were like, yo, we're either going to go bankrupt or we got to move up, you know, to the capital region in New York and try to figure out how to manage real estate. And that's what we did. So
before then, you weren't working full time, managing apartments.
Before
were you still a teacher?
I was still a teacher. I was a teacher until 2011. So okay. I was a full time teacher until 2011, public school, high school, and I was doing full time real estate, managing my own properties, and learning how to do that. I mean, again, you know, drinking out of a fire hose type thing.
Right.
It's tough when you look back on it, man. And I'm sure you know, as in starting your own companies and all, you look back and you're like, what the heck, man? How did I get through that? You know? And
right. Yeah.
You know, and have little babies at home that are, you know, crying through the night. And I'm going up to the capital region, which is 2.5 hours from where I lived. I basically lived there the entire summer in 2007. And we were just, my brother and I were hustling. And at the end of the summer, he was going to law school. So, and I was going back teaching. So we had a tight deadline. We got to figure this out in 2.5 months or else bankruptcy. So we had to do that.
You know, it's interesting how you mentioned that, and you started off with talking about how your degree is pretty much worthless when it comes down to it. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's one of those things that Robert Kiyosaki talks about, is that we're kind of told in our life to avoid failure. And that's what school teaches us, is to avoid failure, like failing on a test is bad. But in reality, it's those pressure moments and those failures and those mistakes that kind of push us in a certain direction. And it definitely pushed you guys into launching something pretty substantial with a pretty high purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I discovered over that period of time, you know, every book we were reading on property management and real estate was the mantra was, treat people as income. This is business. And, you know, just put up a wall between you and the tenants, and you're just there to collect money. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the way I was raised, man. You know, I'm a person deep with faith and, you know, love of God. And I was like, you know, I see other human beings as equal in the eyes of God. And I wasn't down with that mentality and that, but I had already gotten into it. So I'm like, man, I'm not treating people like that. Like, if I'm going to Ryan's house and collecting rent, I want to know how he's doing, how his family, how his wife and kids are doing, how, you know, how his business is going. And then I want to see if there's anything I can do to improve his home. And that's what I did. And I thought for years, man, I thought I was doing that at the, at the cost of profit. You know, I thought, oh, I guess I'm just not a good businessman and I must be leaving profit on the table, but you know, my vertical relationship's more important and I'm going to do it this way. Cause I want to glorify people and acknowledge their dignity. And, dude, it turned out the opposite. I mean, what happened was Ryan, in turn took better care of his home, not of his, you know, he wasn't just a tenant. He was a resident, you know, and it wasn't right. A unit that he lived in. He lived in a home, you know, and us
right.
Talking like that, man, language is so important and people forget that, you know, and
yeah,
we used that language because we believed it and it helped them believe it too. And it really just gave them a sense of ownership and more pride in where they lived. And we were in all tough areas, lower income areas, tough neighborhoods. And we over time, people's behavior started changing. So they went, you know, they would start paying rent on time or early. So we wouldn't have to chase them down all the time. Time is money. So not having to chase is you're saving money. Then they would clean up common areas, you know, instead of me doing it or me having to pay people to do it, they would just do it themselves. Because again, this pride of ownership, man, they're taking ownership and it was just from me respecting them and acknowledging them as human beings, you know? And then they would tell us if there was other like shady neighbors, drug dealers or whatever, and we would evict them. And then they would refer other good people in. So they were doing our marketing.
Right.
You know, also all this stuff was cutting down our expenses and it was costing us nothing.
Yeah.
I'm like, dang, man. I'm a slow learner, man. It took me like 3 or 4 years. I'm like, wait, I'm like, this is actually the better way to do business. I'm like, what are all these books talking about? So that's kind of how we founded Avesta, man, on that, those principles, you know. In 2010 was when we, after my brother graduated law school, I'm still living in Connecticut. We got together with another guy from his law school, Nate Fisher. And we said, let's make this big. My brother Pete was like, let's blow this out. You know, we had learned our lessons from those years. And, you know, we kind of broke down that approach that I just shared with you. And my brother was like, yeah, that's how we got to do it. So that's how we started it.
So yeah. You didn't just set up, I mean, you started off like, hey, I'm going to make some passive income with a couple fourplexes. And what that turned into is not just a real estate company or a real estate investment. What it turned into was a very principle-centered business. Can you walk us through like the stages of like what was going on in your head when you were sitting down, you sat down and mapped out all your values and you're like, you know, we want this to be people-centered and we want to improve communities. What were some of those pillars, those foundations of setting up this company?
Yeah. So for one, you know, in a bigger scheme, I would say I've never been much of I'm a very long-term thinker in terms of lifetime length, you know, and where I want to be at the end of my life. And, you know, I think you have to be, if you're going to have a lot of kids or be willing to have a lot of kids, is you got to
right.
be willing to delay some gratification and invest in your retirement through having company that loves you rather than, you know, just vacations or something. So
right.
I'm a long-term thinker in that way, but I'm not like a 5-year goal type of guy. You know? And if I had been, I could tell you right now, there was never a time 5 years ago that I would know at all that I would be where I'm at right now, 5 years later. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Right. Yeah.
So when I got into real estate, I was not thinking, oh yeah, in, you know, 13 years, you're going to have 400 employees. And you just don't like that right. was never on my radar. That wasn't a bucket list thing. It was nothing. It was like, no, I got into real estate for practical reasons, but then there came a purpose behind it, you know, and a mission. So it was founded on, to answer your question, that idea that, man, you can really, by acknowledging people's dignity and like really respecting them, you can actually start building community, you know, interactive community for people, and just through acknowledging them and their families and all that. And then you're creating these positive environments for people to live just by taking the little extra time and screening the people that are moving in there, you know?
So you are actually, part of your strategy was actually going into some of these areas that might've been, you know, a little worn down, people not paying their rent, maybe even drug dealers around, and you'd improve these communities and
definitely
and start treating people like people instead of a rent number. And you'd see major differences.
major differences that I went through before. I mean, if you start treating people like people, they'll start acting like people, you know? Yeah. And again, man, you're a teacher. I think most people who would be listening to this can relate if their parents are, or if they've had to influence anyone. I mean, if you treat people the way that you want them to act, they'll start acting that way, you know? Yeah. If you disrespect them all the time, they're going to start acting disrespectfully back, you know? But the same is true if you hold them to a high standard. So yeah, that's what we do. And there was high standards too, man. Like at first there were times where I would allow people to pay their rent later than normal late fee, you know, because of the bleeding heart stories and the bills and all this other stuff that they had to pay, or their husband's sick and yada, yada. And I'd walk out of there and pat myself on the back and be like, yeah, you just did a good deed. And then 5 days later, they'd be like, hey, can I get another 5 days? I'm like, oh, it's okay. You know, okay. Another pat on the back. Then it's like going into the next month. And I remember thinking one day, I'm like, they may as well have just come right into my apartment and stolen $700 off my table. I'm like, this is stealing like anything else. I'm like, yo, if I have a cart full of groceries and I'm walking out of a grocery store and the person at the register, the cashier is like, hey, where are you going with that? I'm like, oh, thanks, Ryan, I'll pay you later. I walk out of the store. Like, what does everybody say that is?
Yeah, stealing. It's a thief, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's stealing, right? But when it comes to not paying for your shelter, it's like, right. Man, you're a slumlord. Like, what are you doing? So I realized early on. So I'd be very nice. And I learned from teaching, like, you don't have to yell to have authority, man. You just have to be consistent. So that's what we did. And, you know, people would get evicted. And once one person would get evicted, everybody knew, like, oh crap, this guy ain't playing. And he's also respectful. So, you know, when they tried to manipulate me for being nice, and realized that didn't work, I was still being loving the whole time. I'm like, yeah, if you're not paying, it's not fair to anyone else, including me. So you're out. Well, you know, so that was it. Yeah. But, you know, building that community, Ryan, that was a big thing. And just giving people a home where they could live abundantly. That's our mission. Give people a home where they can live abundantly. Yeah.
So when you would acquire these properties, would you immediately evict people? Or like there was a restoration aspect to them, a renovation aspect to them, sure, as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it was immediate, but it would be more, you know, we would evaluate where people are at. So we'd go, and with teams, we'd just introduce, you know, at first it would just be us. We'd introduce ourselves and tell them what's up and, you know, see how everything is and what needs to be improved and all this stuff. Where are your frustrations? You know, get a pulse. That was our first thing, get a pulse and assess things. How's the neighborhood? How are your neighbors? So if like five different people are like, oh, Ryan, he's a scumbag. Please get him out of here. This guy's trouble. And then I go to Ryan. He's like super nice. And he's like, yeah, man, I love this place. Everybody loves me. I'm like, yeah, I haven't paid your rent. He's like, yeah, I know. I already drew up a deal with the previous owner. I was paying the 20. I'll be like, okay, Ryan's about to be out of here. You know?
Right.
So we get a pulse. And then, yeah, some people, if they couldn't pay the rent or whatever, then they'd have to leave. We typically would work with them like, hey, how much time do you need? You're not going to get like a ton of time. We'll give you some time to help them in their transition. Cool. Or connect them to agencies. We try that. But a lot of times we put that on them and do our best to help out. You know, we try to give people ownership, man. And in order to take ownership, you gotta give it.
Yeah.
You gotta give responsibility. So,
right.
So yeah, that's what we did.
Oh, that's awesome.
And have been doing.
So when you don't get to 12,000 apartments and $1.13 billion in assets on your own. So tell me a little bit about how you structured the team and the responsibilities that each team member had when you were in this growth phase.
Yeah. Well, look, when you reached out to me to kind of connect and speak with you about this, my first reservation was like, man, this isn't about me, you know, because this didn't happen just because of me. We have 400 teammates here, you know, great people. And the key, man, is it's hiring. It really is. And we took a lot of investment into hiring the right people. We learned that lesson early on from those early days of that great recession that I referred to, that was a rough patch, because you didn't know when the recession is going to end. You know, we look back now, we're like, oh, well, you know, it only lasted to 2010. I'm like, you don't know in 2009 that's going to end in a year. Like, you know, it's just there. And you're like, holy cow, how am I going to get through this? So we would hire really cheap people to do our maintenance and to do, you know, our oversight or general contracting, all this stuff, or, you know, construction, whatever. And man, we got burned so many times, man. And there's no good reason to compromise virtue over talent.
So you wouldn't hire cheap people if you had to do it again. You'd find the best talent and pay them whatever it costs.
Yeah, I mean, within reason. We're gonna.
I mean, not whatever it costs.
Right. We're gonna pay. Right. Yeah, we're gonna pay a premium for the right people, and we're also gonna take 3 weeks to get the right person, even if we need them 4 days from now. Mm-hmm. You know, we're gonna take an additional 2.5 weeks. To get the right person, because I've been through it enough to realize, no, man, there's no urgency when it comes to getting the right person. Like, it's always more important than it is urgent. So an urgency would be like calling the fire department when there's a fire. But right. When you don't have the right person, you do not hire out of urgency, and you have to have the discipline to know that and to actually execute on that. So we learned it from the hard way, man, because those cheaper people would steal from us when we turned our head. So they were great and they could do the work. They knew how to do things. Mm-hmm. They had the talent, but they didn't have the virtue. And when we would turn our backs or, you know, drive home or whatever, they would start stealing stuff. And that, you know, when it costs you hundreds and then thousands of dollars, you start to learn a lesson that, you know, maybe I read that in a book. I don't remember, but I do remember actually losing thousands of dollars. And they won't make that mistake.
One of the things I remember you telling me in the past is that you, in your training, is one of the things that your employees would come up to you and they'd say, oh, well, he's good for the rent. He's, you know, he's just going to pay a couple. Can you tell us how you would handle that?
So, yeah, so when I would give training for our company, so I basically led the recruiting, the hiring, and then, you know, getting the right people on the bus, right? And then training them and developing them and creating a culture around it. And had great people like Shevin McCullough that would just run the hiring, and just incredible guy. But I would tell especially the people that were inexperienced and new and young people that were on the leasing consultant side, or, you know, leasing agents or even assistant managers that would have to collect rent, and they would have always have these stories, and they call up and like, hey Rob, look, I want to give, you know, Ryan, he needs a 10-day extension to pay the rent, you know, and the late fee is assessed. It's $50 late fee. It's assessed 2 days from now. Can we just waive that late fee and give them an extra 10 days? And I'm like, okay. I'm like, listen, you know, Mike, do you really trust Ryan is going to do that? Like, oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. Rob, definitely. Like, I know this guy, he's a good dude. I'm like, you sure about that? For sure. I'm like, okay, cool. So look, let's do this. I'm like, I know how much you get paid and all this stuff. I'm like, just spot him the $800. and he'll pay you back 10 days from now. Ryan will pay you back. Plus, so that you saved him the late fee money. And on top of that, man, now he knows you personally have his back and you put your money where your mouth is, you know? And I would just hear silence on the other line at first. And then I'd be like, yeah, you there? Can we do, you know, like, how about, you want to do that? I'm like, that sounds cool, man. It's very admirable. And they're like, no, you know what? Just a victim. Like 100% of the time, man. I'm like, oh, I get it. What is your money?
You're so generous with the company's money.
you're so generous with the company's money, as if it grows on trees, right? Like, how do you think you get paid?
Right.
You get paid from him paying his rent. So, so that was something I learned firsthand, man.
Yeah. So how did you structure the company? I mean, you had a finance team, you had a marketing team, you have landlords, essentially.
Yep.
So, because you guys aren't just in one place, right? You're all across the nation now.
Well, so yeah, we're throughout Florida. So every major market in Florida, and then we're in Texas. We're in big in Austin, San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas. We're actually building our headquarters there now. You know, we're in Tampa currently, and we're in Colorado, Westminster, Colorado, outside of Denver, and Phoenix, Arizona. So, and yeah, we're expanding. We're looking at various deals in different parts of the country. It's fully integrated, right? So we have a whole finance team that does the underwriting, does the modeling, really tries to assess, you know, for all those familiar with real estate, it's, you know, it's the investment. So you have the valuation, you have the income, which is the NOI, the net operating income, and then you have the cap rates. So cap rates is determined by the market. You're going to get that from any, you know, you call a qualified broker and they can give you the cap rates of your specific market. So you got that cap rate. And to get the valuation, you got to do the income, the NOI divided by the cap rate. The NOI is the trick. You got to figure out what the NOI is. And to do that, you have to do a very good underwriting process. You got to figure out, okay, how much rent are they getting right now? How much rent should they be getting compared to the, you know, competitors in the neighborhood? How much are other people getting? What can you do? What types of improvements would the marketplace like? How much do those improvements cost? And what rent bump are you going to get? From there, you can figure out, okay, this is our estimated NOI. And now you can come up with a valuation, a strike price, that's going to promise us and our investors that this is going to be a good investment and you're going to get a really good IRR, a great internal rate of return on your investment, or cash on cash, like however you want to measure it. It's going to be good if you figure out the NOI, right? Because the NOI is going to inform what price you're going to make an offer at. So then we have the whole marketing team that does our, you know, our sort of website, does our branding, our, you know, swag, all that stuff. The invest the name and image. We have recruiting and hiring. So our HR, we call it people development. They have, you know, they're responsible for hiring, for recruiting, for training, for developing. And then of course the benefits and all that stuff that we want to make competitive. So it's appealing to be at, you know, asset management team to really assess how the assets are doing, how they're performing numerically, and can work with the community management team, which would be the, you know, the property managers, or what we would call the community managers. We call properties communities, but whatever, they're interchangeable. You got the property managers, the leasing consultants, the maintenance techs, the service foremen, all of that foremen. That's the internal team. Now we don't have a construction. We have a construction team as well, but we do that on the, like the GC side, or we'll hire GCs. So major CapEx plans, capital improvements, we hire people to do that. Mm-hmm. And then we just oversee them. And you know, we have the procurement side,
right,
that has national relationships with, you know, suppliers, and trying to think we miss, you know, and then of course the corporate, like, oh, the accounting side as well. We have a fairly large accounting team. We do all of our accounting. So everything's internal, man. I think the one main thing we don't do ground up construction. So we buy pre-existing, you know, and value add, typically late 80s, 90s, you know, class B, B minus, some B plus now, C plus, you know, mm-hmm. And the way the markets turn and the cap rates have turned, and you know, the market's pretty frothy, man. It's definitely a seller's market. So the deals we're looking at more now are newer deals, you know, that are kind of B plus.
Yeah.
Because you just can't get the value out of C plus. The prices are not differentiated enough, you know. Class C properties are just selling for too much money right now.
Yeah.
You know, but when the market turns, that will change. So
do you have a specific strategy as far as what rent rate you want to stay? Are you trying to stay in between like 600 and 1,000 on your?
No, I mean, it's changed. So I think now our rent is closer to 1,000, 1,200, 1,500.
Okay.
But yeah, for the first few years. So we got our first properties in Florida in 2011, March 2011. We bought our first 79 units. It was across seven buildings or six buildings in Florida. And that's when Avesta started. And yeah, so then the rents, you know, from there until 2012, rents were like, you know, 550 to maybe 750, mm-hmm. depending on number of bedrooms, you know, and we're talking, you know, from studio to three bedrooms. But now it's more expensive because the the class of properties has gone up. And that hasn't been like our strategy. You know, we're value add, long-term hold. So right. We're not like, we wanted to get in on where we could, which was high risk, you know, bad areas. And our goal is to get class A luxury. And like, no, that's not our goal. We're trying to be flexible with the marketplace and where can we create most value right now.
Right.
In a long-term, you know, mentality.
Well, as far as where you're finding the properties, are you looking at mostly on the market deals or are you looking at off market deals or is it just kind of a mix?
It's, you know, anyone in this business would say you want off market deals, of course, right? Because
yeah,
it's going to be, you're going to get less bids that rise the prices and all that stuff. And there's so many people that are taking a piece that you're going to end up paying more, but it's hard to find off market deals. So we have a whole part of our investor and finance side. We have people that are constantly bird dogging and trying to find off market deals and relationships, you know? Mm-hmm. So we do get off market deals, but it's not the majority.
Right.
We would love it to be only that, you know,
but right.
They're harder to find, you know?
Yeah.
So
one of the things I find interesting is, you know, part of your story is you built this company. Obviously you're a part of building the company that you have a big team that you helped set up around you as well. You built it to $1.13 billion in assets and you're able to quit your job teaching. And now, just recently you're a very purpose-driven person, which is awesome. And that's been the cause of a lot of your success. Like, you know, the virtue behind not treating people like a number or a rent payment, but treating them like people and how that ultimately affected your business and grew your business. But now you're at the point where you basically like, I'm going to fire myself. And the good thing is you've got the income that's coming in that's allowing you to do that. Can you tell us a little bit about where you are now and how important having that purpose is, no matter how successful you get?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've recently decided on kind of transitioning out from day to day, you know, working through with my brother and our other partners to now, you know, being on a advisory kind of board level only involvement. And that transition's been over like a 6-month period and, you know, I made it official a couple of weeks ago. So I'm no longer actively involved at Avesta. I think looking back, I was not planning on this. And again, if I had a 5-year plan 4 years ago, it would definitely be like, you know, if I had a 20-year plan, I'm going to be at Avesta. But yeah, I just feel as I've been feeling a desire to do something else, something more intentionally related to working closer with people. And it's crazy. I mean, we've hired so many great people that have helped build the company that I feel fine walking away from it on a operational level to allow other people to run it, you know? And I think we've empowered the right people to do so. And I didn't hire them so that I could eventually step away from it. I hired them so we could have the greatest company possible. But they actually have allowed me to step away from it when I felt called to do so.
That's awesome. And,
So
what are you going to focus on? You said people centered, but I know that you're a man of faith. Is there something that you're going to do more with that?
You know, I haven't determined it entirely. You know, there's, I have an idea of, you know, there's Mr. Rogers has come up a lot in my mind, funny enough, but I think he's impacted a lot of my generation and older generation.
Well, he's just like you. He's about building communities and neighborhoods, right?
Yeah, right. During that, you know, during our youth, but just that positive impact. And there was just a movie on him recently, actually, some theaters, I think. But he had a way of communicating to kids that was very positive and really focused on, you know, values and ethics and morals. And I think there's still a void there, and with you know, him not being on the scene anymore. And I think largely it's been filled with, you know, the SpongeBobs and I don't want to say mind numbing shows, but you know, shows that I'm not crazy about my kids watching. I'm like, man, it would be great to have a show that really focused, that drew young people in to a relationship with God or just, you know, their faith and morals that revolved, you know, through laughter, through humor. And I know a couple people that just seemed naturally cut out to do something like that and get out in front of a camera and do it. So
you're not getting to get in front of the camera?
I don't think so. Maybe from time to time, man, but more so, I want to use my talents.
I was about to say, man, you're not cut out for that. You're not Magoo enough. I'm sorry.
No, it's not me. And I'm pretty self-aware to know that, but I do have people that are, I know a couple people, one in particular that would be incredible for that.
So you want to get involved in like some sort of project like that, make a bigger difference.
Yeah. Or, you know, just make a more fulfilling difference for me in the point I'm at right now, you know. And I look back on it, you know, part of me was like, dang, man, did I waste 7 years or 13 years doing this? Like, no, like that was my purpose for the amount of time I was there. And now I'm doing something else. When I was teaching, I didn't get into real estate and it got big enough that I could finally leave teaching. I left teaching because I felt, man, I could really have a huge impact or help have, you know, impacting things in a big level through this real estate thing. Yeah. I didn't know we would be 12,000 apartment homes right now. At the time, I think we were a couple hundred or not even, it was like 150, but I saw potential, man. And it happened and I was like, whoa. But that's why I loved teaching. And, you know, I'd still say right now, I see myself more as a teacher than a businessman. And, but this next thing, it was kind of like, all right, this idea excites me a lot. I think there's a lot of potential there and I think there's a great need for it. And, someone's got to do it. So
that's awesome, man.
So yeah, we'll see. We'll see what's up.
I'm looking forward to it, man. I'd like to see you pop in as a guest wearing a little sweater vest.
Yeah. Nice. Right.
Beautiful day in the neighborhood.
That's right, man. But yeah, I was helping create more community for a while and now just desiring to do something else, man. And you know, it's the last thing I'd say about it is this. It's luring. It's tempting to just stay in a place where you're comfortable, you know? But one of my favorite quotes is, the world promises you comfort, but you're not made for comfort. You're made for greatness. And, that's awesome. You know, I could be comfortable for the rest of my life at Avesta and doing whatever, active or not active, but, you know, involved there on payroll and stuff or whatever. And I was like, man, I'm not a mercenary. You know, I want to be a missionary and life is short. And if you're not working towards doing something fulfilling, then, you know, you got to reevaluate things. And I'm not going to say, I'm not one of those guys that can relate to like, oh, well, if you do something you love, you didn't work a day in your life. Like I never could relate to that right. Statement, you know, work is challenging and it's work, but it should be rewarding. And I think anybody from the person that's a doorman, you know, to a porter, to, you know, whatever, the president of a company, you can find purpose in what you're doing. It's there. You just need to find it. And once you find purpose in what you're doing, it's a whole different level of engagement, man. And you can bring that joy in what you're doing, that pride in what you're doing. You can bring that back to your family, impact them with that. And yeah, man, it's all integrated. So we'll see.
Give me that quote one more time. It's
the world promises you comfort, but you're not made for comfort. You're made for greatness.
Yeah, that's a good quote. I'm going to use that on my next vacation with my kids.
Oh, nice.
Because
nice.
Right now, the only quote I give them is, I didn't promise you fun. I only promised you memories. So.
Ah, nice. That's great. Well, if you want to make them uncomfortable, just put rocks in their mattresses too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, some kids.
And then say the world doesn't promise, you know, you're not called for comfort. You're called for greatness.
Yeah. So go back to sleep and stop bothering me.
Right. Exactly. Cool, man.
Well, thank you so much, Rob. It's awesome. I mean, you shared some really amazing things with us all the way from your story and how it happened. And then some of those things throughout that story, like, you know, treating people with dignity and just having a principle-centered, not just purpose, but a principle-centered business and how that actually helped your business launch. We also talked about how, you know, some of those failures and those challenges and those hard times are some of those things that push you in the next direction of your purpose or where you're supposed to go. Totally. And then you also shared like some incredible nuggets of just like analyzing deals and creating a structure and a team and shared some of the wisdom and the practical knowledge of setting up an investment like that. So thank you so much, man. It's been awesome having you on.
Hey man, I'm just a normal guy, man. I'm happy to be here and thanks for having me, dude.
All right, man. Appreciate it.
Boom. Thanks for listening. Please remember to rate and subscribe. You're going to want to listen to every episode as soon as it comes out because each episode has in it an idea or a strategy that could literally change your life. And listen, don't miss out on the free investor tools that I have for you on my website, cashflowdadlife.com. So go to cashflowdadlife.com and get your free swag. And listen, hit me up if you want to talk about how we can get you out of the rat race as soon as possible. Until next time, my name is Ryan Ank, and this was Cashflow Dad Life.